Greetings and follicular regenerations, my fine listeners, and welcome to this May 2013 Science News Update. I'm your host for this post-May Day and post-Cinco de Mayo science podcast, Jim Campanella. First story of the night was pointed out to me in the popular press by my lovely wife. Eyeing my salt and pepper hair, she informed me that scientists had found the cause and a cure for graying hair. I was less than sanguine, to say the least, especially after reading the silly Yahoo article that she forwarded to me. As with most articles of its ilk, it lacked detail and did not even tell who the names of the researchers were who made the discoveries. I am not vain, and I would never color my hair to make my premature locks look any darker. But if there was some way to convince my hair to go back to being dark by some method that bypassed such unnatural means, I would be interested. So I dug through the literature until I found the original article that had been referenced. I was not surprised that the news agencies had not exactly been honest in their reporting. The title of the article had nothing at all to do with hair. To say that the story was poorly reported in the media is putting it mildly, with all the headlines speculating that the findings could lead to a cure for gray hair. This was a textbook example of PR officers sexying up a dry but worthy piece of research to gain maximum media coverage. The article by Dr. Karen Schallreuter of Arnst University was published last month in the FASEB journal. It is entitled, Basic Evidence for Epidermal Hydrogen Peroxide Peroxynitrate-Mediated Oxidation Nitration in Segmental Vitiligo is supported by repigmentation of the skin and eyelashes after reduction of epidermal hydrogen peroxide with topical narrow-band UVB-activated pseudocatalase. Yes, that is a mouthful. What does it mean? Well, it means that Schallreuter was not looking for gray hair cures, but she may have found one anyway. Schallreuter and her group have been studying the disease vitiligo. Vitiligo is a genetic disease in which patches of skin and hair of the affected become bleached of pigment. They look piebald in terms of skin and hair color, as if they'd been splashed with bleach and it literally bleached patches of their skin and hair. Schallreuter's work has turned up evidence that vitiligo is caused by an overproduction and/or lack of degradation of hydrogen peroxide in the skin and hair follicles. Hydrogen peroxide is able to bleach melanin, the primary skin pigment, so the skin cells look dead white, like somebody with albinism, or a White Walker if you're a fan of the Game of Thrones. And now for the cool part. Dr. Schallreuter has found that after 6 to 9 months of treatment with a special enzyme, more on that in a second, she can get the skin and hair of those affected people to repigment almost back to normal shades. Now a couple of points. First, we all have enzymes that break down oxygen radicals. Those are highly ionized oxygens that can damage DNA and proteins, and hydrogen peroxide falls into that category. The chief of those enzymes are catalase and peroxidase that break down such molecules, and they are primarily inside cells and do their protective work there. It turns out that Schallreuter treated the skin and hair of vitiligo patients with a cream with an altered form of the enzyme catalase, called pseudocatalase, that is sensitive to UVB wavelengths. She was also able to get their skin and hair to turn back to normal after long enough treatments to reduce the levels of hydrogen peroxide in the skin and hair follicles. I have seen the photos of before and after, and they are frankly amazing. It was found that the first sign of repigmentation occurred as early as 2 to 4 months after the initiation of the therapy, and complete repigmentation of the face and hands of patients was seen in about 90% of the group. Repigmentation with pseudocatalase cream can be achieved in all skin colors, she says, and is independent of the percentage of depigmented skin and the duration the patient has suffered the disease. The paper also noted that no patients developed new bleached lesions while on the therapy. My second point is that another paper also in FASAB way back in 2009, of which I didn't even know existed, showed that white hair in aging humans is also caused by increases in hydrogen peroxide in the epidermis. So therefore, you bring the two discoveries together and ta-da, you have a potential treatment for white and graying hair. My smart-ass wife wanted to know if I was going to go down to my lab and whip up a batch of pseudocatalase now that I knew what they used, and I told her I didn't need to because it is already commercially available. Yes, it didn't take long for companies on the web and other places to jump on the bandwagon. You can now get pseudocatalase cream if you don't mind paying through the nose and really want to sacrifice your hair to science. But I strongly recommend not doing that quite yet. As I have said previously, it is always wise to just wait and see if scientific claims are still true in a month or two or a year down the line. And it is sometimes dangerous not to wait for all the data to come in. Besides just the plausibility of the scientific claims that are already out there, there is also already controversy about which companies online are selling the real pseudocatalase used by Schaltreuter and who is not. I suspect that the FDA may be stepping in on this very soon if this keeps up. Schaltreuter says, quote, "Copies of our pseudocatalase are advertised worldwide now. One ineffective copy of pseudocatalase cream plus calcium has been advertised by Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois. Be aware of advertised pseudocatalase products where there are no peer-reviewed publications in the international dermatology journals that support or substantiate the efficacy of these products," unquote. Just to show you that scientific results are not always to be believed, a new article in the journal Biotechniques tells of a lab technician, not even one of the main scientists in the group, who, yes, made up data. A former tech at the North Carolina digital microfluidics company, Advanced Liquid Logic, faked the results of federally funded HIV research, according to the Federal Office of Research Integrity. As a consequence, he will face increased supervision on federally funded research for at least the next 3 years. Matthew Poor falsified lab results in a June 2012 report and a July 2012 presentation to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, according to the ORI's notice published in the Federal Record on April 30th. In addition, the falsified results were recorded in the company's laboratory records. Poor reportedly changed HIV viral load results for two patients from positive to negative, and changed another result from negative to positive. In two other instances measured in the notice, Poor fabricated results from experiments in order to hide the fact that he had never performed them at all. In August 2012, Poor's employment with Advanced Liquid Logic ended shortly after these instances of misconduct were discovered. Again, the only point of this story is that somebody doesn't need a PhD to falsify data. They only need to want to rise up in a company in the ranks, or even just keep their jobs a little longer. As part of a voluntary settlement, Poor has agreed to be supervised on any federally funded projects by any institution that employs him for the next 3 years, and to exclude himself from any advisory role to the U.S. Public Health Service during that time. However, the chances of him actually getting a new job are slim to none, since now he can't exactly be completely trusted. Next story. According to the NIH, the quest for an AIDS vaccine has suffered another setback. The National Institute of Health announced last month that it had stopped immunizing volunteers with its anti-HIV vaccine because it had become clear that the vaccine simply just didn't bloody well work. Since the trial began in 2009, 1,250 volunteers had received the vaccine and 1,244 others had gotten a placebo, both as a series of shots over 24 weeks. Most of the participants were sexually active male homosexuals. Among volunteers who had been in the study for at least 28 weeks, 27 infections occurred in those getting the vaccine and 21 in placebo recipients. Of all study participants, regardless of how long they were in the study, 41 HIV infections showed up in vaccinated volunteers and 30 in those who got the placebo. The vaccine used a double hit strategy designed to rev up the immune system. Three early shots were intended to prime the immune system. Then, 16 weeks later, the participants received a booster shot that delivered genetic material made up of molecules produced by HIV, with the goal of eliciting an immune response against the virus. The vaccine itself could not cause HIV infection because there were no actual viruses. NIH says that they will be trying new vaccines in the future, but this particular one seems to be a bust. The next story will hopefully make up for the seven-sexed tetrahymena bust from last month. This story from the journal Biology Letters has to do with cross-dressing cuttlefish. Now, cuttlefish are pretty amazing because they have the extraordinary ability to display intricate changes in color and shape, and they can utilize that as a form of visual communication. Not only that, but they're very smart. Their colors convey specific signals. For example, during courtship, aggression, or to fend off predators, they can change their color and the shape of their body. Although in an ideal world, communication signals among individuals would always be honest, deception can sometimes be fruitful. The deception risk is sometimes worth it when the benefits that can be gained from cheating are worth the risks of suffering the consequences if your fraud is discovered. Dr. Coulomb Brown and his colleagues from Macquarie University in Sydney describe how male cuttlefish deceive other males into believing they are actual females while at the same time trying to court a female. In this way, they can avoid being interrupted during their love dance. Brown noticed that in some instances when a male was courting a female in the presence of another male, the side of the courting male's body facing the other male would exhibit female coloration, while the side facing the female would display courtship signals. Now, to me, that's just bloody amazing. Like one of those half-men, half-women you used to see at sideshows and carnivals in Kansas in the 1930s. Anyway, to determine the frequency and success rate of these deceptions in different types of social groups, Brown and his team observed the visual displays of cuttlefish in the wild in 108 different courtship groups. They took photos of the main male in the group, that is, the male that was performing the courtship display, and then of all the other individuals within the group. In addition, they made similar observations of courtship displays in captive individuals. The researchers observed many different types of social groups, some with more than one female and some with more than one male, but they only observed those deceptive tactics in groups where there was a male courting a single female in the presence of only one other competitor. This tactic was employed 39% of the time within the social group, and through observations on the captive cuttlefish, the investigators were able to confirm that successful mating occurred when this tactic was used. Their results suggest that cuttlefish, as I said before, are very smart. The authors even believe they're able to gauge how likely they are to get caught when using deception, since they only use this tactic in the presence of one other male when they are least likely to get caught, and they never use it in big groups. Okay, so the cuttlefish story may not be very titillating to you, but you gotta admit it's pretty cool. Well, here's another animal story from the Journal of Experimental Biology from this month. Elephants only exercise at night. Okay, your first response may be, yeah, right, so what? Why is that important? Well, for one thing, it may tell us a bit about dinosaurs and other equally large animals. Dr. Michael Rowe from Indiana State University has found that in large hot-blooded animals that produce their own body heat from metabolism, bouts of exercise under sweltering sun and tropical conditions can be potentially lethal. In short, if an elephant does aerobics in the sun long enough, it will probably die. Equally, the extinct, hot-blooded Edmontosaurus dinosaur that had a decreased skin surface area to body mass ratio compared to elephants was likely to find it more difficult to get rid of excess heat produced during exercise. However, no one has ever conclusively proved this. So Dr. Rowe and company decided to examine elephants in the hopes of better understanding dinosaurs. Rowe exercised two elephants by walking them around a closed circuit for about 20 minutes under the full sun, over a whole range of temperatures, from 8 degrees centigrade all the way up to 34 degrees centigrade. By measuring their core and skin temperatures, as well as the walking speed and the environmental factors such as the air temperature and solar radiation, the team could then calculate how much heat they produced from increased metabolism and how much heat they lost to or gained from the environment. Rowe found that the elephant's metabolic rate increased 2 to 2.5-fold regardless of whether the animal exercised in the winter, spring, or summer. However, like you would expect in the hot summer, radiation from the sun and the environment meant that the elephant's skin reached the same temperature as their core body, 35 degrees Celsius compared with about 24 degrees in November, meaning that 100% of the heat generated by exercising was stored in the core tissues, with the body temperature going up by about 2 degrees centigrade. From their findings, the authors could predict the limitations this put on diurnal activity in both elephants and big hot-blooded dinosaurs. For elephants, about 4 hours of exercising in the sun would see their body temperature steadily increase to a lethal 43 degrees Celsius, and then they would keel over and die. Similarly, something bigger than an elephant, like an Edmontosaurus, would likely last only about 3.5 hours. According to Rowe, at night, without solar radiation heating up their skin, both elephants and endothermic dinosaurs could exercise for up to 8 hours without overheating. Mind you, I have no idea why an elephant or a big dinosaur would want to exercise, but I guess it's actually nice to know this. Onward and upward. Did you ever wonder why humans and not many other animals have such big brains? This is a really good question because it relates directly to whether or not we are ever going to find any other intelligent life out there in the universe. To be self-aware, you really need a big brain. Why are they so rare in nature here on Terra? Well, one hypothesis has been that big brains come at a price. Big brains use up a huge amount of energy. And the bigger the brain, presumably, the more energy is needed. Even though our brains account for only about 2% of our body mass, humans use up to 20% of our total energy expenditure on the brain. So there's a theory called the expensive tissue hypothesis that suggests that the size of the brain is part of a trade-off between the advantages of greater cognitive ability and the energy demands that having a bigger brain entail. Well, it's only a theory, but this month in the journal Current Biology, Dr. Alexander Kartoschal of the University of Uppsala has decided to examine the validity of this hypothesis. Kartoschal says that a key prediction from the model is that developing a bigger brain should come at the expense of other tissues, most notably the gut tissues, the other most energetically expensive tissue in our bodies. Well, a number of studies have shown that for many animals, brain size and gut size are negatively correlated, no one has done experiments to test whether evolving a bigger brain affects the size of the gut. Kartoschal decided to determine if the effects of artificial selection on brain size would support the theory. First, his group bred multiple generations of guppies, and for each generation, they selected the individuals with the largest and those with the smallest brains, thus creating what he called an up-selected group, and a down-selected strain of fish. His group found that after only 2 generations, the brain size within the up-selected group had already increased by 10%, showing that brain size is a trait that can rapidly change during evolution. Then, they determined whether the fish with larger brains are smarter. Guppies have a crude sense of numbers, so you could put the fish to the test using simple numerical learning tasks. They found that fish with bigger brains did better at the counting task than their down-selected counterparts. This result supports the idea that a bigger brain gave them a cognitive advantage. Furthermore, when Kartoschal weighed the guts of the fish for the two different groups, he found that the larger-brained fish had 8 to 20% smaller guts. This result demonstrates that acquiring a bigger brain leads to having a smaller gut, and shows that the increase in brain size is the result of a trade-off between cognition and metabolic cost. There seems to be another expense of having a big brain. Kartoschal found that The bigger-brained fish seem to have fewer offspring per generation than the smaller-brained counterparts. This suggests that increasing brain size comes at the expense of the reproductive process, as well as the gut size, I guess. For those of you who are fans of the original Star Trek TV show, this next news story may make you think of a Horta. For those of you not familiar with the original Trek, the Horta was an underground, burrowing animal that was terrorizing miners in the episode Devil in the Dark. Why do I bring it up at all? Well, the most noteworthy thing about the Horta was that it was not a carbon-based life form. It was an organism who has a silicon-based biology. For those of you who are not chemists, biologists, or geologists, carbon and silicon are both very special in the periodic table because they're able to form very complex compounds because of their ability to make four symmetric bonds. It has long been hypothesized that life could be generated using complex silicon molecules that mimic those of organic life. Well, Dr. Lee Cronin of Glasgow University has decided that he is not going to wait until somebody digs up silicon-based life on a moon of Jupiter. He is going to create it himself. In the Journal of the Scientist, he describes this work. He's been working on generating what he calls inorganic chemical cells. He says, quote, "What we are trying to do is create self-replicating, evolving inorganic cells that would essentially be alive. You could call it inorganic biology." Unquote. The cells can be compartmentalized by creating internal membranes that control the passage of materials and energy through them, just like real cells, and they can have several chemical processes going on within those isolated organelles, again, just like biological cells. Cronin says the cells, which can also store electricity, could potentially be used in all sorts of applications in medicine as sensors or to confine chemical reactions. Quote, "The grand aim is to construct complex chemical cells with lifelike properties that could help us understand how life emerged and also to use this approach to define a new technology based upon evolution in the material world, a kind of inorganic living technology. Bacteria are essentially single-celled microorganisms made from organic chemicals. So why can't we make microorganisms from inorganic chemicals and allow them to evolve?" Unquote. Yeah, good question. I don't know. Could it be because it's stupid and dangerous? I mean, frankly, it sounds like one of those high-tech horror novels from Michael Crichton, where a group is doing something for the good of humanity until things go horribly wrong. I hope that whatever this crazy Scott creates does not escape and get out of control or simply become a new bane upon our already stressed Earth. We could really do without micro-hortas running amok out there. The final story of the night is some really cool news. Last month in the journal Nature, it was reported by Dr. Jessica Alfoldi, a researcher at MIT, that the genome of the coelacanth has been sequenced and analyzed for the first time. You may remember coelacanths from grade school or high school as those rare living fossils that were caught accidentally by African fishermen decades ago. Well, they're not quite as rare as were first thought. In fact, there was a photo of a diver with a coelacanth on the cover of Nature last month. When I saw that, I asked the marine ecologist who was down the hall from me whether it was photoshopped, and he just stared at me and said no. And I said naively, "But I thought that they were rare. How did they get a photo like that?" And he said, "Yeah, they were rare until we found out where they live off the coast of Africa, and now we can find them whenever we want." Well, that was news to me. I don't know how big they actually get full-sized, by the way, but the one that I saw on the cover in the photo of Nature was almost as big as the diver, which had to be at least a good 5 feet, so they get pretty big. Well, despite what my colleagues said about coelacanths being less rare, Alfoldi waited almost a decade to start her sequencing, because she never had enough DNA samples, and she needed the process to be as efficient as possible. She said, quote, "Once we had them, we were worried that we wouldn't have enough DNA to sequence using the old Sanger technology, so we waited for the next generation sequencing technologies to come up to speed. Then we waited even longer because we just had one shot at it, so we didn't want to screw it up, unquote. Even after all that waiting, there was still not as much high molecular weight DNA as she and her team would have liked. The researchers wanted to sequence the fish's DNA to determine whether its genome has actually evolved as little as its prehistoric outward appearance would suggest. The modern fish looks eerily similar to its fossil, and the team found that the coelacanth's protein-coding genes are evolving significantly more slowly than those of other four-limbed vertebrates. Four-limbed vertebrates are called tetrapods, and while the rest of the genome is changing at a kind of normal rate. The scientists suggest that this could be because the fish lives hundreds of feet below the ocean surface, where conditions have remained pretty constant over the last few million years, and where there are a few predators. Due to its inaccessible habitat, the coelacanth has been presumed extinct for 70 million years, until a South African trawler actually dredged it up in 1938 in a net. In addition, when you compare the RNA sequence data of the coelacanth to the West African lungfish, the group found that the coelacanth is not the closest living relatives to tetrapods. It actually appears to be the lungfish, although the lungfish genome has not been sequenced because it's gigantic, it's huge. It has 50 to 100 billion bases in it. The researchers also pinpointed genes and regulatory elements of the coelacanth involved in the adaptation of animals to dry land, since the fish was clearly moving in that direction, since it has fins that look like short limbs. And it was found that the genes involved in fin development, for example, were lost, while those coding for the urea cycle were altered. In water, animals can excrete pure ammonia because it's diluted before it reaches toxic levels. But on land, animals produce the less toxic compounds, urea or uric acid. This project, along with the one sequencing woolly mammoths, may be the closest that we are ever going to get to sequencing actual fossils. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Don't trust any male cuttlefish. Keep away from Scottish hordas. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.